Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, joined by Cicely Marie, my co-host and producer, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. I'm here with our guest today, Wesley Smith, who's a good friend of mine. And as I mentioned in the intro, that Wesley's written quite a few books. In his earlier days, he wrote Winning the Insurance Game, The Frugal Shopper, Collision Course, The Truth About Airline Safety, written with his good friend, colleague, Ralph Nader. When I first came to know of Wesley and his work, his book Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, had just come out. And then soon thereafter, he published Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. So, Wesley, thank you for being with me today to talk about all things assisted reproduction.
Thank you, Jennifer, and hello to your audience.
Thank you. Did I get your books right? Is there anything you want to parade around that I didn't put up?
The Culture of Death book has been updated and revised in 2016 because so many things that I worried about had actually happened. So the new title is Culture of Death, The Age of Do Harm Medicine.
Yeah. And we certainly see that a lot in what I call big fertility, which we discuss all things big fertility here on Venus Rising. So would it be fair to say that you started out, you were a lawyer by your original vocation. Would it be fair to say that you got agitated and became a consumer advocate when you were working with Ralph Nader in your early days?
I actually worked with Ralph in my middle days. I quit practicing law for reasons that are not germane to this interview. And began to do some writing and ended up, I won't get into the long story, but writing a book called The Lawyer Book, A Nuts and Bolts Guide to Client Survival, which was my first book. It was a consumer's guide to being a client, in essence. And when I turned in the manuscript, I said to the editor, wouldn't it be wonderful if my hero, Ralph Nader, wrote the introduction? So she sent it to him. He loved the book. He wrote this amazing introduction. I think in part because of that introduction, the book really took off, and that launched me as an author, and Ralph and I ended up, he introduced two other books, and then we co-authored four books, and when I got into the anti-euthanasia and assisted suicide work, which we won't talk about today, that's when I left working with Ralph and started pushing on my own on these, what I call human exceptionalism agendas. And the big fertility issues, the issues the CBC works on, are crucial aspects of the attack on human exceptionalism.
And you wrote in the corner quite a bit on so the whole area of gene editing, designer babies, CRISPR. I mean, what do you see, the brave new world? What are you seeing that's happening that you were predicting 10, 20 years ago?
Well, it's very interesting. When the stem cell issue, the embryonic stem cell issue broke in 2001, when Bush put very modest restrictions on embryonic stem cell federal funding, the biotech issues became one of the top issues outside of terrorism in the country and throughout much of the world, with much of the media focused on trying to destroy the Bush approach. What George W. Bush said, and I thought it was very important, is he said, scientists are smart enough and imaginative enough to find ways forward to provide the kind of benefits we're hoping for from embryonic stem cell research without destroying nascent human life in the process. And it was very interesting because he was right. Over a period of time, the induced pluripotent stem cell were invented. That is turning skin cells into stem cells that can become any tissue in the body. Those are already in testing. They are used in tissue lines and so forth for drug testing. And George W. Bush proved very prescient and very correct in his approach to these biotech issues. But unfortunately, he's really the last president to try to grapple with this most important field head on. With the gene editing, genetic engineering, human cloning, these kinds of creating life that is not found in nature, artificial life, you have some of the most powerful technologies ever invented by the human race, including the splitting of the atom. And of course, some of these issues become very germane to the big fertility issues and treating women as objects in that whole field. And yet, we find that President Obama, President Trump, and others just abdicate their moral responsibility of leadership here. These issues, these agendas, these technologies are so powerful. They can unleash incredible tragedies upon the world, like if somebody wanted to gene-edit a bird flu, we could have a pandemic. They could result in women being used as mere uteri, if you will, in terms of child-rearing. Or they can result in true beneficence. But we need to get a handle on it, and nobody seems to be willing to get a handle on these agendas with proper regulations, proper laws, in order to perhaps lead these the scientists, who are incredibly brilliant, into fields that are potently ethical as well as beneficent, and avoiding the unethical and immoral that could clearly happen if we aren't careful.
We have a bill in California right now that actually our past governor, Jerry Brown, vetoed twice, and that would allow women to sell their eggs in order to advance scientific research. The irony is not lost on me, because I believe the actual name of the bill is the Women's Reproductive Health Care Act.
Ah.
So in order to do research on women's reproductive health, they want to pay healthy women to sell their eggs for research. And I still remember being in the car with you. We were in Southern California driving to some meeting where we were both speaking. And you and I can't remember, I want to credit the right person, came up with the film title, Eggsploitation. It might have been you, might have been me, but we both, whoever said it, we both
it
said that's
a joint enterprise.
Yeah. So, and of course, that was why Governor Brown vetoed the bill twice. He understood once the scientists got hands on women's eggs, they didn't care if you went to Stanford or you were smart or pretty, because you're not using eggs to make babies. You're just doing bench research. Why is it only just the politicians? Why aren't these good, imaginative scientists ethical anymore?
I wouldn't go as far to say that they're not all ethical, but there's in this, I call them, quote, the scientists, close quote, there is this agenda of a utilitarian idea. We're going to benefit humankind. We have to find out, the scientific inquiry, and we need to find out what we want to learn and so forth. And sometimes what does get lost is they're going to be victims with regard to these kinds of enterprises. When women have their eggs extracted, it's not this minor little procedure where nothing happens. They have to be, as you know, they're hyper-stimulated with hormones. Their ovaries, instead of releasing one or two eggs in a cycle, release 30, perhaps. There's an invasive surgery through the vaginal cavity. They have to be under anesthesia. You've recorded very well the potential side effects from this. It can be cancer. It can be an ovary that swells up to the size of a grapefruit or something. And there have actually been some women who've died through this process because of the side effects. So why in the world, I mean, would we want scientists to be able to persuade women to risk their lives, when the women who are going to do it are not going to be the wives of the scientists? They're not going to be the women who live in Beverly Hills or in Bel Air or in the upper class neighborhoods. They're going to be people, women who may be struggling to feed their family. They're going to be poor women. They're going to be women who may not have the education to understand the potential risk that they're developing. Without even the idea of, well, we're going to be able to help another person have a baby. This is going to be for human cloning research. This is going to be for research into three parent babies and embryos. And it is just a means of exploiting some women. And it's stunning to me that supposedly progressive politicians in California, in the legislature, which has no checks and balance because they own the legislature now, don't even see that they're opening the door to the exploitation of women, when supposedly they're big, wonderful feminists and doing what's best for women and female equality and so forth. It's baloney. They're using women in the same way other people may use women in different means, perhaps through sexual use or whatever, only this is actually in some regards more dangerous, because you are dealing with women's basic biology and you are messing with their normal natural cycles.
And again, in California, where we don't want hormones in our food or our water, But yeah, well, happy yes. to pump it into a healthy
and
woman.
And I know that from your work and some of the other things I've read, women who are the egg suppliers is what I call them, because they're not donors, egg suppliers, they're not really the patient. What the doctors who are taking those eggs are really after are the eggs. And women have talked about how they felt totally dehumanized and almost like they don't matter much. And once those eggs are extracted, then suddenly there's often or there can be a different attitude towards these women if they start to run into side effects or problems, perhaps emotional problems, because they're just a means to an end.
Right.
They're not really a patient. They're a means to an end.
Right. And in exploitation, several of the women either lost their own fertility. So these are women who were egg sellers who will to help people have babies that will now not be able to have children, or they had compromised fertility requiring them to have assisted reproduction in order to conceive children of their own, which is, you know, in the film Exploitation, we use a tagline about the dirty little secrets, and there's a lot of dirty little secrets. And again, the irony is not lost that it's Women's Reproductive Health Care Act, because who could be against understanding better women's reproductive health? We're all for that.
And you know who's going to get rich off of that are the scientists and the scientific industrial complex, because these scientists often then do startup companies and end up with, if they succeed, with a lot of money. The women who sold their eggs for, in essence, a pittance will not benefit from that at all and may actually be harmed by it.
Right. And when we can move on to some of the more Brave New World stuff, the CRISPR gene editing, three-parent embryo, again, it always starts with a very sympathetic story.
Sure.
You know, there's this couple with this horrible, inheritable genetic disease. We're trying to help them have a child that isn't going to be affected by this disease. We're just going to use a little bit of the mitochondria from the egg donor. Again, we're harming a healthy woman in order to do this high-tech baby making. What do you see as some of the, other than the safety factors, just some of the ethics around it? What are the things that keep you not able to sleep at night?
Well, you're using these potential children, if they become children, as experiments. This is human experimentation. We don't know the consequences of this long term. These children, if they're able to be born without any health issues upon birth, and that's not a given, we know that with animal cloning, often because you're dealing with a broken egg that is then recreated in order to create an embryo through cloning. Now, the three embryo process isn't technically cloning, but it is very similar in the sense that you're breaking one egg, fixing it, putting other materials into that egg, and then reconstituting it and fertilizing it. We know that in animal cloning, there's often problems with gestation. There may be serious birth defects for the animal that is born, and so forth. And there may potentially be health consequences as those animals go through life. So we're going to say that we're going to make a child, which is basically a form of manufacture, because you're taking one woman's egg and you're taking out the mitochondria, or you're taking out the nucleus and you're putting it into another woman's egg who has a healthy mitochondria after you've taken out the egg nucleus from that egg, then you're fertilizing it. That's a broken egg to start with when you fertilize that egg. Then you're going to probably do a pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which will take out of a cell from an embryo that was created from a broken egg. And then you're going to, if it passes muster, you're going to probably implant several embryos to see if they will get to birth. Perhaps, what if four of these embryos take, then you're going to do an abortion, selective abortion, to take out one or two of the fetuses that are gestating. And then if these nascent human beings make it to birth, you really are going to have to follow these children through their lives to see if there are any long-term health consequences of having been manufactured from broken gametes. That is on ethical experimentation. It is also, in essence, as I said, I use the term manufacture on purpose, you're creating children through a manufacturing process. And that means you're also applying quality control processes. And that becomes really close to what Aldous Huxley warned about in his prescient novel, Brave New World. I would urge all of your listeners to read it. It was written in 1932. And the stuff he warned about is happening now. And so the entire, from the beginning, the entire process is rife with ethical and moral failures and lapses that also will impact how we look at human beings generally. And how do we look at people who may be born with disabilities and so forth, since we're now moving to first fulfill what a parent desires. I'm going to have, not only do I want a baby, but I get the baby I want. That's a big problem. And secondly, when you're starting moving in this kind of eugenics idea of improving the human race and using PGD to make sure we don't have any problems, which will start with health and then move to enhancement. It's already moved to enhancement in some regards. Is this the right hair color? Is this the right race, we might even say. Then we end up in a circumstance where the child is basically a product. And that's an unfortunate place to be, because as far as I'm concerned, that really is a body blow to unconditional love.
Yeah, and we already see that in, you know, when you look at the egg donation catalogs, they have catalogs of egg donors, profiles, sperm donors, right. You know, how pretty are they, how smart are they, how strong are the men, you know, do they speak a foreign language or play a musical instrument? So it's all design, picking and choosing. It's a product that we're making, manufacturing.
There's an old joke in that regard from a long time ago where Marilyn Monroe and Einstein get together, and Marilyn Monroe says to Einstein, "Oh, what if we have a child and it'll have my looks and your brains?" And Einstein says, "Yeah, be careful. We might end up with my looks and your brains." It's an old joke, but you know the ability, just because these gametes are taken from people who have good eugenic looks or good eugenic stock, doesn't mean that will be the outcome, because we're not just the product of our genes. We're not gene machines. We're human beings, and there's so much more to us than that. On the other hand, when you decide you're going to change a natural genetic makeup to try to create a child in your own image that you want for that child to satisfy yourself, you're actually taking human freedom away from that child through the naked power of genes. Which, so let's say you're a religious fundamentalist, and we find out someday that a propensity, it'll never be like a blue eyes, but a propensity to have strong religious beliefs has a genetic component. Well, what if the religious fanatic decides, I'm going to make sure that my kid believes in religion, and genetically engineers the child to have that propensity? You've actually taken free will from that child with regard to spiritual issues, religious issues, and so forth. And it is to satisfy the parent, not so much to benefit the child. So once you get out of direct health, for example, making sure a child doesn't have a Huntington's disease gene, you're really entering into very murky waters, because there's also the issue of the unintended side effect. For example, the gene that leads to sickle cell anemia also helps protect against malaria. So if you do away with the one, are you going to hurt with the other? And the Chinese fellow scientist who genetically engineered the twin girls knocked out a gene that can be involved in being infected with HIV. Well, first off, it didn't need to do that for the girls, because they weren't going to be infected with HIV. But secondly, it also means they maybe have a greater propensity to being infected with influenza.
And a shorter lifespan.
And a shorter lifespan. Yeah. So what have you done? You've actually taken those girls and caused them harm. And did you do it for them? No, you did. The scientist did it for himself, to be the first one to get it done. Which gets to the point of how we're supposed to trust the scientists to have these voluntary guidelines that they will all follow to protect against abuse. It's not worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah.
Because if the, quote, rogue scientist goes rogue, then, we wring our hands. But I'll tell you, the scientists were not upset at JK, as he's sometimes called, because of what he did. They were upset about when he did it. Yeah. Because the path had not been cleared with the propaganda to say, we want genetic engineering of children.
And you wrote recently on the whole issue of male uterine transplants in animals. I mean, do you envision a day when we're just going to try to implant uteruses into men?
There was a, early in the bioethics movement, there was a bioethicist named Joseph Fletcher, who kind of was in a fight for the soul of what would become the bioethics field with a Christian ethicist named Paul Ramsey. And Paul Ramsey's approach was to say, we have to treat, he called it the patient as a person. That's a famous book of his. That's a series of lectures. And of course, you have the Paul Ramsey Fellows named after him for a reason, because Paul Ramsey advocated a human rights-centered, human equality-centered, sanctity of human life, human exceptionalism-centered bioethics, and that's how we should gauge on what, how to approach these various ethical conundrums that are coming up with high technology. Joseph Fletcher, on the other hand, was the crassest of utilitarians. He didn't think human life had any meaning whatsoever in and of itself. All that mattered, in essence, was the will of the person. And he actually wrote back in the early 80s, I believe it was, that someday men will be able to have uteruses implanted, transplanted into them so that they can have babies, that the men would then gestate a child, and then the child would be born through cesarean section. And isn't that wonderful? Well, now you're beginning to see with these transgendered politics some talk about, well, we have to allow a transgendered woman who is biologically male to be able to have the experience that is unique to women, which is childbirth. And they're actually planning on doing, or somebody wants to do, he hasn't been approved yet, uterine transplants into male mice to try to begin to work out how that could be done. I objected to it very strongly. Number one, I don't believe you should ever do that in the first place. But number two, that's animal abuse. Why are you going to put these animals through this kind of rigor and suffering for no real ultimate purpose other than it's either ideological or to say, look what I accomplished in terms of an Island of Dr. Moreau kind of attitude. This is irresponsible. And I hope that the ethics boards at these universities all reject the idea, because there's no basis for doing that.
Something else that's coming down the big fertility pike or superhighway is, you know, the whole area of artificial wombs, the manufacturing of synthetic egg and sperm. Our good mutual friend Bill Hurlbut at Stanford is always telling me, you know, they're working really hard to make synthetic egg and sperm. Will human reproduction become obsolete?
In the way that we do it now,
yeah. or even the IVF stuff, we won't need egg donors, we won't need surrogate mothers, we won't need.
Well, the idea eventually, if they're able to do a couple of things, one is they're trying to use that induced pluripotent stem cell process to create eggs, so they could take a skin cell, let's say your skin cell, and turn it into an egg cell, and then if they can mature that egg cell, either fertilize it. Or perhaps use it in terms of a cloning technique. Whether they'll ever be able to do that, I don't know. But if they're ever able to create eggs artificially, or if they're able to, another idea is they're taking ovaries from later term abortions, the ovaries of the fetuses, which have, you know, most of the eggs that they would have ever had they been allowed to become women, and see if they can mature those eggs that are already existing in a primitive form. If they can ever do that, if they can get mass egg production in some fashion, then the ability of scientists to do all kinds of things, from cloning to genetic engineering to fetal farming, that is, creating fetuses not for the purposes of being born, but to have them created, put them in an artificial womb if that ever is developed, and I believe it will be, and then doing experiments on them or perhaps using them for organ transplants becomes very real. Some in the bioethics community, following in the steps of Joseph Fletcher, have actually talked about fetal farming and have actually talked about actually paying women who wish to have abortions to gestate for a longer period than they would otherwise in order so that the fetal parts would be more usable, which is just to really treat human life as a meaningless piece of mud. Mm-hmm. And when you think about Vermont, which just passed a law creating a fundamental right to abortion, through the ninth month. There's no limitation, but that isn't the point I want to make in terms of this discussion. They also, in that law, have a statement that said no embryo or fetus has any rights that must be honored by the state. It reminds me of Dred Scott, where the Dred Scott decision said that African Americans have no rights that any white person has to honor. So even if this isn't about an abortion issue, the law of Vermont now says that people may want to do with embryos or fetuses, even outside the woman's body. There's no fundamental reason, at least in terms of the value of this nascent human life, to stop it, because they said they have no rights. They're mud. It's almost like they, you know, we're going to make a potter's clay or a statue. You do whatever you want with this life. But that's human life. I'm sorry, that's human life. And even if one doesn't believe that these are conscious entities, and they're not, that doesn't mean they're not human life. And if we're going to treat some human life that way, based on, for example, say, well, they're not really persons because they're not self-aware, well, then can we also do that to born people who lose their self-awareness or who are born with serious cognitive deficiencies? We have to be very careful. And when you deny the importance of human life simply merely because it's human, then there's almost no limit to what you can end up justifying.
Where can our listeners follow you and find you? What's your Twitter handle?
I'll be hiding under the bed, yeah. Now, I'm on Twitter, at ForcedExit. And please, I post all my articles on Twitter. I also have the Human Exceptionalism Facebook page. I'm with the Discovery Institute, and that's an affiliation with them. And I also have my own Facebook page.
And you blog at The Corner.
I blog at The Corner, and I will put those blogs up at, that's on National Review Online. I write for The American Spectator from time to time. And some other places. But if they will follow me at ForcedExit on Twitter or on Facebook, then, or they can actually subscribe to me in an RSS feed, because I have a service that does that.
Aggregate yourself.
Then they can read what I write on all of these issues.
I'm going to close with one of your articles that you wrote on The Corner, the blog, basically scolding medical doctors for giving healthcare treatments when there's no medical need in the space of big fertility. And that's something I'm really, really concerned with, when we don't have any kind of medical need, whether it be the egg donor who's taking all these drugs, like you mentioned, going under these medical procedures, and then, you know, selling her eggs. But we also see it in, you know, having insurance companies, providers, having to now extend medical benefits. We see same-sex couples, single people, having the benefit of medical care when there's no medical need, or this whole egg freezing, you know, that Silicon Valley is for their employees, providing these medical benefits. Is this just another corruption of medicine, or is this big fertility at play?
What really set me off was an opinion from the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. And they basically, in this opinion, said that even if the doctor knows that the further attempts at artificial reproduction will not work, that they can do it anyway if they feel it will make the patient feel good or have a better psychological effort, because they tried. They did everything they could to try. Realize this is very expensive. These are procedures that doctors make a lot of money off of. And so they're basically saying it's okay for a doctor to do what is considered a physiologically futile effort to get this woman to be able to have a baby, which to me is unethical as hell, because you should not do an invasive procedure or any other kind of procedure if you're a doctor that you know is not going to work. And they even went so far as to say if the doctor knows, not even if it's like a 1% or 2% chance of working, but said physiologically futile. It used that term in the ethics opinion, that they should be able to do it anyway if they feel it'll give the woman a psychological benefit. Well, they're not being paid all that money to give a woman a psychological benefit. They're being paid all that money because a woman is desperate to have a child. And they're taking advantage of that, I think, to begin with in many regards, but certainly if they know that she's not going to actually succeed, that is just an exploitation or an exploitation of a most dramatic kind, in that it's been sanctioned by the big organization that promotes big fertility, says everything you need to know about big fertility.
I'm going to ask you one last question, and this has been in the news a lot. The young gentleman who was a military cadet who was injured in a skiing accident, and his parents, before they ended life support, banked his sperm. And the judge just ruled a few weeks ago that the parents can use their deceased son's sperm to create grandchildren. Is this just more of the, not the parents' wishes, but now extending it to just the grandparent wishes?
Yeah. I haven't thought too much about that case, but it really is an idea here that people have a right to what they want, even if it's something that would normally not happen. So we're now taking the jurisdiction of healthcare, if you will, away from, let's say, well beyond treating diseases, preventing pain and palliation, promoting wellness, to making people happy. So we're using very expensive medical technologies to give people what they want in terms of life fulfillment, not just to heal broken bones or treat cancer. And then they wonder why we can never get healthcare costs under control, because the jurisdiction of medicine has gone well beyond what is a traditional medical issue into lifestyle, happiness, personal fulfillment, and this kind of thing. And I don't think that's healthy at all.
And back to your point earlier about the experimentation on children, you know, in the olden days, it was always what's in the best interest of the child.
Right.
And now it's in the best interest of the intended parents.
Or the intended grandparents.
Because,
you know, one understands that the grandparents are deeply grieving because of the loss of their son and wanted to have grandchildren. Well, sometimes you can't get what you want. So this child is going to be created, is never going to know his father, because mm-hmm. his father was dead before he was even created through in the Petri dish, if that happens, or in artificial insemination, however that's going to be done. These are family issues that I don't think we've even really thought through. We've got disintegrating families now, broken family structures, and yet we keep creating newer and more, in some regards, extreme novel family forms, and wonder why sometimes people are confused.
Yeah, I often say that this whole space of big fertility is one of the largest social experiments of our time.
Yes, it is.
And when you look at some of the early fertility doctors who've been interviewed and in print pieces, one fertility doctor in my state, California, your ex-state, California, said in the early days of fertility medicine, we were literally throwing spaghetti on the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah.
Making it up as we go, learning as we go, using women's bodies often without even their knowledge or consent.
That's right. And I want us all to remember, and this isn't a moral issue, but it shows you how the idea of, well, these will be strictly controlled, is empty promises, hollow words. When IVF began, it was supposed to be for married couples who could not otherwise conceive and have children. Well, now we see these technologies used for a broad array of social concerns or personal desires well beyond the married, the rare infertile married couple. You have women who have hire surrogates to carry their babies who are perfectly fertile and capable of carrying them themselves, but don't want to for whatever reason, whether it has to do with their physicality or their career issues. So we have taken these powerful technologies, which were barely accepted to begin with promise of strict guidelines to protect against abuse, and we've completely lied and busted all guidelines. So for your listeners, next time they hear somebody saying, we're going to just do this one little thing, and we're never going to allow it to get beyond this, but this particular circumstance, because this one very emotional need of this one particular circumstance, they're lying to you. They want to get the foot in the door. They will always use the hardest case to do it. And there is no way that protective guidelines stick over time because you've accepted the premise that it's acceptable to do these manipulations. And once you've accepted that premise, the rest is just a matter of time to break down what weak barriers exist, preventing us from going as far as the imagination allows.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Wesley, I love you because you have so little passion on these issues. But thank you for being our guest here at Venus Rising. You can follow Wesley Smith at Forced Exit on Twitter.
Yes.
And you'll be up to date on all of his blogging and writing and his articles. So thank you again for being with us today, Wesley.
Jennifer.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising with Jennifer and Cicely. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.